contribution to civilization. From astrology straight to biology, hey, what it is? Black my story. Originated by African, hey, they say they found it. Hey, they stole it from my motherland, and they claim they invented it. But I tell you, originated by Africans. They say they found me, but they stole me from my motherland. They stole me from my motherland. Took me from my African. They stole me from my motherland. From Marrakesh to Egypt, Rio de Oro, from Cape Town to Addis Ababa and Congo. Somalia, oh land of the good Ghana.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, the bluesologist coming to you from the not-so-great white north here in Toronto, Canada. And we kick the show off today with the music of Ziggy Marley, the son of Bob Marley, the oldest son of Robert Nestor Marley, and the Rasta man who has been to the Caucasian crib. Ziggy actually went to the White House and met with President Barack Hussein Obama, and that is another story. But Ziggy won the Grammy for the best reggae recording in the Grammys, and he beat Barris Hammond, and a lot of people thought that Barris Hammond should have won, and he also beat Sly and Robbie, who have been guests on Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. But we are going to be playing a lot of great music this week. This is the first show that we're doing on African Liberation Month or Black History Month, whatever you refer it, whatever you call it, but we referred to it as African Liberation Month. We have an action-packed show for you today. We're going to be speaking with Michael Hamlin, and Mike Hamlin is the author of a book called A Black Revolutionary's Life and Labor, Black Workers' Power in Detroit, and Mike Hamlin will be on at 2:30. We are also going to rebroadcast the interview that we did last week with Alnisa Barbara Banks, the publisher-editor of The Challenger, which is a African weekly coming out of Buffalo, New York, a weekly newspaper. And we're going to be paying tribute to Horace Silver, who is still in the land of the living. Horace Silver, who is known for his song, Song for My Father. And his father was born in the Cape Verde Islands. And a lot of great people came out of the Cape Verde Islands. Amil Carcarol, Tavares, Sweet Daddy Grace. I don't know if we want to put him in the great people that come out of the Cape Verdes, but yes, Sweet Daddy came out of the Cape Verde Islands. But Cape Verdeans have played a great role in the history of African people, and Tavares, the singing group, came out of the Cape Verde Islands. And we would like to thank Chairman O'Malley Ishitela, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party and the African International, African Internationalist, African International. And we would also like to thank Archie Shepp. Chairman O'Malley gave us the space to do Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and Archie Shepp gave us the idea of Diasporic Music in the West, and we sneak into some music from the African continent itself. And last night we went to a great concert here at Colonel Hall, which had great musicians from Mali. But right now, we want to present some great music, and we wanted to reflect on Black history and the world. And this is the late, great Gil Scott-Heron.
Ah, yes, the world, planet Earth, third from the sun of a gun. 360 degrees, and as new worlds emerge, stay alert, stay aware, watch the eagle, watch the bear. Earthquaking, foundation shaking, bias breaking, new day making change. Accumulating, liberating, educating, stimulating change. Tomorrow was born yesterday. From inside the rib or the people cage, the era of our first blood stage was blotted or erased or TV screened and defaced. Remember, there's a revolution going on in the world. One blood of early morning revolved to the one idea of our tomorrow. Homeboy, hold on. Now more than ever, all the family must come together. Ideas of freedom and harmony, great civilization. Yesterday brought today will bring tomorrow. Neon, Leon, fast lane, brother, you were yesterday when dreams of karma and life still live. As it was in the beginning, so shall it be once again. Earthquaking, foundation shaking, investigating yesterday. I was wondering about our yesterdays and digging through the rubble. And to say the least, somebody went to a hell of a lot of trouble to make sure that when we looked things up, we wouldn't fare too well. And we would come up with totally unreliable pictures of ourselves. But I've compiled what few facts I could, I mean such as they are, to see if we could get a little bit of light. This is what I got so far. first, white folks discovered Africa and claimed it fair and square. Cecil Rhodes couldn't have been robbing nobody, because hell, there wasn't nobody there. White folks brought all the civilization, wasn't none around. How could these folks be civilized when wasn't nobody writing nothing down? And to prove all their suspicions, well, didn't have to wait too long. They discovered there were whole tribes of people in plain sight with no clothes on. That's right. The women, the men, the young, and the old righteous folks covered their eyes. And no time was spent considering their crime. But hell no, this just wasn't civilized. Another way they knew the folks were backwards, or at least this is how we were taught, is that unlike the civilized people of Europe, these tribal groups actually fought. And yes, there were some rather crude implements, and yes, there was primitive art. And yes, they were masters of hunting and fishing. Courtesy came from the heart. And yes, there were medicine, love, and religion, intertribal communication by drum. But no paper and pencils and other utensils, and these folks never even heard of a gun. So this is why the colonies came to stabilize the land. The dark continent had copper and gold, and the discoverers had a plan. They would discover all the places with promise and didn't need no leases or deeds. Then they'd appoint people to make everything legal, to sanction the slavery and greed. And when the natives got restless deep in the jungle, they would call it guerrilla attack. And never described it, folks finally got wise and decided that they would fight back. Still, we are victims of word games. Semantics is always a bitch. Places once called underdeveloped and now called mineral rich. And still we are constantly hounded with unity just beyond reach. Egypt and Libya used to be in Africa. They've been moved to the Middle East. There are examples below, I assure you. But if interpreting was left up to me, I would swear every time this version ain't mine. That's why it's called his story. Earth shaking, foundation quaking, bias breaking, new day making change. Squarely on the
Li Hao, and I'm speaking some Mandarin because that is going out to Uncle Roy Heron. Uncle Roy is Gil Scott Heron's uncle, who's still in the land of the living. He is in his 90 plus, but he is Gil Scott Heron's uncle, who lives here in Toronto, and he always wanted to go to China, and he was studying Chinese, studying Mandarin, and he was always looking forward to going to China. So we would like to send that out to Uncle Roy Heron, who I think is in the Sunnybrook Hospital, but we send our thoughts. Well, we always think about Uncle Roy, and today is the Super Bowl, and I guess everybody's talking about this brother, Richard Sherman, out of Compton, and he is has a very, well, he's educated, went to Stanford for whatever that is worth, but the very articulate and very outspoken, and he's on the right side of history, and they're playing against the Denver Broncos, and I don't follow football. Everybody in my family play football except me, but I might check this one out to see what's going to happen. But right now, we want to, this is African Liberation Month. Most people refer to it as Black History Month, but it began as Negro History Week, and in the 60s, it became a month, and you know, it is started. It was started by Carter G. Woodson, and some people say, you know, we started with as Negroes. Now we're Africans. We started with a week. Now we have a month. And some people feel that instead of just dealing with Black history, we should deal with African history, which would deal with the whole world. And instead of dealing with just history in terms of inventors and so on and so forth, which there's definitely nothing wrong with that. We should deal with liberation. We should talk about Dessalines, and we should talk about Ya Asantewaa, and we should talk about struggles going on right now all around the world, and we should also talk about the unity between African people, the unity of African people, Asian people, Bandan people, and progressive Europeans. And we are getting ready to play some music from Sweet Honey and the Rock, and they're going to do a song dedicated to the great Ella Baker, a great organizer who taught Kwame Ture, who taught Jamil Alameen, who taught Dr. Martin Luther King, and this is Ella song from Sweet Honey in the Rock.
You believe in freedom, cannot rest until it comes. You believe in freedom, cannot rest. Hear me talking to you. We believe in freedom, cannot rest until it comes. Until the killing of black men. Mother's sons is as important as the killing of white men. White mother's sons, you believe in freedom, cannot rest.
Sing it with me if you like it.
We who believe in freedom, cannot rest until the older I get, the better I know that the secret of my going on is when the reins are in the hands of the young who dare to run against the storm. Cause to me, young people come first. They have the courage where we fail. And if I can but shed some light, I'll carry us through the gates.
We here believe in freedom, and I'm telling you how. And struggling myself don't need a whole lot. I've come to realize that teaching others to stand up and fight is the only way my struggles survive. I'm a woman who speaks in a voice, and I must be heard. At times I can be quite difficult.
I want to bring to you something about you. It is a quote. I quote, "Our worst fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We were born to make manifest the glory of God within us. It is not just in some of us, it is in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others." This is with gratitude to Marianne Williamson, everybody.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. There's a little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. There's a little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Yes, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine, shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. May we know that together. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Everywhere I go, everywhere I go, I'm gonna let it shine, shine. Everywhere I go, I'm gonna let it shine. Everywhere I go, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
All in my room, I'm gonna let it shine. All in my room,
I'm gonna let it shine.
All in my room,
this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light, this light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine, shine, shine.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, and joining me on the line from Detroit, Michigan is, I always call him Mike Hamlin, but he has a new book out called A Black Revolutionary's Life in Labor, Black Workers' Power in Detroit, and he's calling himself Michael Hamlin, so I guess he's going back to what his mother named him, right?
That's right.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine, and I'm so grateful to you for this opportunity to speak to your audience. I appreciate it, and let me say that I haven't seen you in a long time, but you know, I really admire you for your accomplishments.
Well, I haven't put out a great book like this. So I planned to try to put mine together now, but I'm very impressed with the work that you put into this book, and you have captured, you know, a part of Detroit, and I think Detroit is one of the most important cities in the Western Hemisphere. When we talk about the history of Detroit, we're talking about, some people have compared Detroit to Haiti in the sense that it's a city of resistance, and it's a city where the state has always tried to come down on people in Detroit historically. Would you agree with that characterization?
Absolutely, and I will, if we have enough time, I have a poem at the end that speaks to it. It was written by the colleague who helped me with this, Michelle Gibbs, whom I think you know.
Yes, sir.
And it speaks just to that point that you raised. But Detroit, the problem in our country right now, as in Detroit, is that the people are not being well-educated. You knew John Watson, who was a brilliant man, and John used to say to us, and I say this in my book, he always asks you, what is your analysis? Very few people are analyzing Detroit, not just Detroit, but the United States correctly at this point, and especially vis-a-vis blacks, which has always been the case since our history has been suppressed.
I don't want to cut you, but John Watson, we need to talk about who John Watson was, because a lot of people don't know. We're talking, you and I know John because we work with him, but who was John Watson?
John Watson was a brilliant a genius. Actually, he and Ken Cockrell were two geniuses that I had a great privilege to work with them in their formative years. And John, he had an intellect that was so intense, and he was driven to understand the black condition, as I was, as most of us were, who during that period who had a little bit of intellect. He had kind of a super intellect, and he studied hard with everybody, and he had a hell of a base of knowledge and analysis, and he's the one who introduced me to revolutionary politics. Marxism, he and I together introduced Ken to it, and you know we
Ken Cockrell was like a Johnny Cochran who was a Marxist Leninist Johnny Cochran.
Yeah, but you know Johnny couldn't hold a candle to him. The cases he won.
I agree with that.
Were unbelievable. And as you know, he called a judge. All kind of names, racist, hunky, dog, pig, pirate, and defended himself and won, as well as freed a number of brothers who were the Panthers who were charged with murder, first-degree murder, and he got them off, and also a man who killed two people in the plant, Johnson.
Ken.
Yeah, Ken did that. So, you know, they were geniuses. And John is a powerful figure that, you know, because he worked tirelessly. He worked kind of, he had the worker ethic of the people that I come from who worked the fields where I was born.
Mississippi.
But in Mississippi. He did that in a, you know, and intellectually. He was driven, but, you know, he had to be propped up. I stayed with him long hours in the night, in the morning. He couldn't sleep because his mind was, I've never seen anybody like that. His mind was driving him, and he was constantly working. He could learn anything. He learned how to publish newspapers and got us started in publishing a newspaper.
Making films.
Yeah, he made a film called Finally Got the News that's being shown all over the world even today. And in schools in this country, at Wayne State and several different departments, some classes show it. And it's about us, and it's about the things that we did. But I started out by talking about the analysis. Currently, we are we're in a peculiar stage, and the people haven't caught up with it. As you know, the people take a while to catch up with things. But we are now, a couple of things have happened. What has been suppressed is the history of the black movement after the nonviolent movement died. And that was, before King died, it was in 66 when the SNCC started talking about black power. And it certainly completely died in 68 when King was killed. But the... but so everything, all the gains that black made in this horrific country in the 60s and 70s were attributed to the civil rights movement and the power structure accepted that and promoted that because it was nonviolent. But the civil rights movement did not move or cause one policeman to take a step back in harassment and brutality and killing young blacks in the street. Didn't change any relationships in the auto plants, which is where we came in. And none of us were nonviolent, as you know. And we let it be known that our policy was self-defense, and in fact, on offensive, if necessary. But anybody who talks about the United States, the civil rights movement, the nonviolent movement is what got it done. I'm going to be saying that now, and I've been saying that for two years. Last week, the most hated man and the standing the schoolhouse door guy in Michigan, Brooks Patterson, came out and said what I've been saying, that they're trying to move us toward a Bantustan type system. That as they did in South Africa, and it's based on us arriving where they. I once read that in South Africa there were the blacks became known as throwaway people because they didn't need them anymore, and that's what we have here now. And you know, I'm sorry I did all the talking. I know you want to ask questions.
I just want to let people know that I'm speaking with Mike Hamlin, the author of A Black Revolutionary's Life and Labor, Black Workers' Power in Detroit. Now, you know, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers was started at the same time as the Black Panther Party. And do you feel that the League of Revolutionary Black Workers has been shut out of history? And if so, why?
Not only the League, but they're also shutting out the Panthers. I mean, the contributions of the Panthers were enormous, even though some of that policies, in my view, were misguided. But even the RNA.
The Republic of New Africa, okay.
Yeah, the Republic of New Africa. And various organizations that sprang up as a result of our development. We were the first one. The Panthers and us were the first one to confront various aspects of this system. The Panthers, as everyone knows, I think, took guns into the state legislature in California, which is a big state legislature. We attacked, we shut down two plants for days, for 3 days each. We disrupted church services across the country because the black churches were, I mean, the white churches have benefited from slavery and exploitation and murder of blacks throughout history. And that history was suppressed. As J.A. Rogers, the great black historian, said, he who robs me of my good name, he's quoting Shakespeare, does me harm indeed. And so what had to happen is that the people who run this country had to discredit blacks, and that's when they went through that period of trying to prove scientifically that we were somewhere between the ape and a man. That's the if you Google scientific racism, they'll tell you all about that. That's the whole of the 19th century, from 1800 on into the 30s, you know, the ideals was being promoted and strengthened that blacks had a brain to put them at the size of which put them between man and ape.
Right.
So that's suppressed. And then they of course suppressed the great, they say that blacks never contributed anything
to civilization.
To civilization,
and, when we contributed civilization itself, yeah.
Yes, and you know, what's his name? Rogers disputes that, Now, Rogers was the first person I read that said blacks are a despised people.
Now, we're talking about Rogers. We're talking about Joel Augustus Rogers, who was born in Jamaica, but came to America, and because he was so light-skinned, he had to jump through hoops. In Jamaica, he was big stuff, but in America, he was nothing but another N-word, you know. Yeah.
Baldwin says the same thing in The Fire Next Time, that we are a despised people. So what I've come to learn, and, I've done it in my travels, this is all related to my writing the book. What I learned in my travels is that I or any black man can go almost any place in the world and be attacked, because the man who has suppressed our history has also defined us throughout the world and is continuing to define us and refine that definition throughout the world. So people are intimidated and afraid of us. So we find ourselves, I tell people that I could walk, get off a train in Russia or Bulgaria somewhere, and they might jump on me because I'm a pretty big guy. I'm old. And a young strapping black man, like, say, for example, one of my nephews who's over 6'4", around the world. I teach this class at Wayne State, by the way, in black studies. And one of the things that I have my students do is interview an older black person. But one of my students decided to interview an African, a brother from Nigeria. And they're supposed to interview them on how they see race relations in the United States. Well, the brother from Nigeria told her, well, you know, I don't like Afro-Americans. None of the Nigerian students on campus like Afro-Americans.
He made a generalization like that?
Yes, and the Africans, none of the African students like Afro-Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that was probably exaggerated, but I don't write it off completely.
Let me say this before you complete that. I have a cousin from Saginaw, Michigan, who married a Nigerian brother who was a doctor, and when they got divorced, the family almost denounced their daughter because this brother was, they loved him so much because he was such a helpful type of guy. But I mean, I don't want to cut you, but I just want to throw it in there.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying that. I mean, I'm just telling you what this Nigerian said, he's speaking to the ones on Wayne's campus, and I don't. I don't think he would make it up, but he wasn't talking to me. He was being interviewed by actually a Native American girl, beautiful Native American girl. He told her that.
Right.
You can see, having lived here, that these folks can create that kind of, the result in immigrants who come here, no matter where they come from, because they do it abroad.
Oh no, that's part of the imperialist program, right?
Yeah. So that's what I've been doing, and that's what caused me to write that book, because I know that our people are going to have to confront what we had to confront, because what happened was, the Panthers hit him in the nose and backed him up a few steps with police brutality, and we did too, because Ken won all these cases against the police and defeated stress, drove stress out off the street. But they're coming back because we have let down our guard, our vigilance. We're not vigilant. These young people don't know what to do.
We only have about 10 minutes, and I want to ask you a couple of questions. There's something that I always wanted to ask you about the role of that the league took on culture, we were able to, you know, do benefits. I think we brought in Freddie Hubbard and people like that. And Ken Cockrell, I believe Ken Cockrell was pretty close to Dennis Edwards of the Temptations. Is that true?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. When Ken was in college, he and I rode him to work every day. I dropped
Detroit
him off at
News.
School. Yeah, I dropped him off at law school, and I'd go on to work. And he decided to run for Congress, for state rep.
Right.
And so he, Dennis Edwards was just getting started. He had a pickup group. And Ken lived in the projects. He lived in, Wayne State had two projects in the housing project complex.
Right.
And Ken lived there with his wife and son. And
Ken Cockrell, Ken Cockrell Jr. became the mayor of Detroit for a moment, right?
Yes, yes. And so I was Ken's campaign manager, and I told him we ought to have an event in Jeffrey's project and try to get the people to vote for him. And as a matter of fact, we held a concert out there in the square in the projects with Dennis. And, you know, I mean, he had not had been that well-known then. But,
right.
You know, he did it for us free, and it was a wonderful music thing. And we had no idea he was going to become who he was. But Ken lost that contest. I think he lost it to Ed Vaughn. It was
Ed Vaughn used to own the Vaughn's bookstore in Detroit.
Yes.
Right.
And remember the leader of the Republic of New Africa.
Omari Obadeli or Milton or Gaidi?
No, Ed. Ed Vaughn was a member of that organization.
Thought Ed Vaughn was a back to Africa man. I didn't know he was with the RNA, with the Republic.
Well, he was with the RNA. Anyway, he won that, and Ken didn't win. He was, you know, he wasn't 30 years old at the end of that old thing. And, you know, he after that, he was not into running for office, but he finally did, you know, did the end of his involvement with the league. He went and ran for council, and he stayed there one term, I think, and became disgusted and quit.
Right.
But you know, Ken was one of the things that I'm concerned about is that there is no street named after Ken or no monument, and I want to work with people if certain sectarian attitudes can be overcome. We need to build a statue to him because the contribution of that brother are enormous. Not, no matter what you think about him, yes, he was brilliant. Yes, he was arrogant. Yes, he. Yes, he was angry, but we were all angry.
Well, I remember Ken Cockrell he would always boast about the fact that we in the league we were able to stay out of trouble with the police because
right.
I think we had differences in terms of tactical differences with Oakland, and I think that Fred Hampton actually came to Detroit, and there was a little activity that took place between. I think it was everybody was basically saying that Fred came in, and Glanton Dowdell was the guy who did painted the Shrine of the Black Madonna. I guess one of the security people for the league, and
mm-hmm.
there was a little. That was a little thing, but nothing really. We had a comrade relationship.
Yeah, we could not come to agreement. We rejected that tactic because
right.
they were doing. You know, Huey believes and promoted the concept of revolutionary suicide.
Right.
And you know, whether or not he meant it or intended it to happen. They created circumstances where that could happen, and I remember what used to happen is they would go into, they would take over a house, and then they would barricade themselves in there and arm themselves heavily and try to draw the police in. And then somebody would always call us and tell us that this was going on, and we would call Representative Conyers and tell him, and he said he'd meet us over there. And we'd go over there, and he'd talk to the police, and we'd talk to the Panthers and get them out of there. So it never happened in Detroit.
Right.
But that was, you know, I believe that the notion of revolutionary suicide, which is extant now in the Middle East, was something that they picked up from here. That's just my belief.
Well, the Panthers, they had all kind of relations with the, you know, on the positive tip, the league and the Panthers, we had a, we supported the Palestinians, whereas a lot of other the nationalists, some nationalists didn't support the Palestinians because of.
And we supported, we were anti-Vietnam.
Oh, big time, right?
Yeah, I was. Interesting story, since you were in Canada. I was the only black person who was crazy enough to cross the bridge and speak on the platform with the Vietnamese ambassador to Canada and the one from Cuba.
Right, right.
So here I am with, you know, they got an auditorium full of basically white Canadians, and these two... and they'd had the Cuban ambassador and ambassador to Havana. And I'm sitting up there on the stage with them denouncing the Vietnam War. Not thinking, you know, I didn't think about things like that, the consequences of it. Didn't really matter. That's what I'm saying about these young people today. They're going to get it to a point where they can't live this way anymore. And... when that comes, they're going to find out that what nonviolence will get them. I'm not against nonviolence, and I don't denigrate. I materially supported the nonviolent struggle in the South. I raised goods and sent money, tried to help those brothers from SNCC when they wanted to get conscientious objective status in by
the war.
For the Vietnam War, but with Reverend Clegg, but Clegg reneged on them. So they were staying at my house. About 13 of them were staying at my house while they were here to get a term to be ministers. But, you know, I think the FBI probably told him to reject that. That's a bad idea.
All right, Mike, we have about a minute, and I basically wanted you to let people know how they can get a hold of your book and how they can get a hold of you.
Okay. They can get a hold of me. Well, first, here we go. They can get a hold of me by going to MikeHamlin@yahoo.com. And to get my book, you can go to www.againstthetidebooks.com. It has to be books on there because there's a lot of Against the Tide. But againstthetidebooks.com/author. /Mike Hamlin, and I have a phone number, 313-247-2267. Now, I really appreciate this because I've been had this stuff on my chest about the throwaway people. Did you do you recall that?
The throwaway people?
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. I mean,
I can't find it in any literature here in the U.S. anymore.
Right.
Yeah. And the only other thing I was going to say is during the 60s, the African liberation struggle, two brothers came to my house from the ANC, and we helped, we sheltered them and took them around to speak at a couple of places. I sure wish I could hear for some of them. And if anybody knows, this brother was a journalist named Armstrong. If anybody knows who he is, let him know. I would hope they would let him know that we would like very much to hear from him.
Okay. All right, sir, and we appreciate this interview, and we should try to get you back because we only scratched the surface, and we definitely think that the League of Revolutionary Black Workers should be studied by our youth and by all youth, all people all around the world need to study the history of the league and study the history of Detroit and all the revolutionary RNA, the Black Panther Party, African People's Socialist Party, so on and so forth.
Next time I'll give you those two poems that I was talking about.
Oh, yeah, definitely, most definitely. So thank you very much, and I appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, we're going to listen now that we know how to get you.
All right. Take care, my friend.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. We have been speaking with Michael Hamlin, author of A Black Revolutionary's Life and Labor, Black Workers' Power in Detroit.
My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, the bluesologist from Toronto, Canada. And we were speaking with Mike Hamlin of Detroit, and he has a great new book out called A Black Revolutionary's Life in Detroit, Black Workers' Power in Detroit. But we are paying tribute to Horace Silver, who is still in the land of the living, and Horace Silver was born in Connecticut. But his father was born in the Cape Verdean Islands, and there are a lot of Cape Verdean people in Connecticut and on the East Coast, and the Cape Verdean people have played a tremendous role in the history of the world. One of the greatest persons from the Cape Verde Islands, of course, is Amilcar Cabral. Amilcar Cabral was Cape Verdean, and he led the struggle in Guinea-Bissau. He was the head of the PAIGC, and he led the liberation movements. The liberation movement was the Portuguese, against the Portuguese. You had the brothers and sisters from Angola, Mozambique, and Guinea-Bissau, and Amilcar Cabral made a speech in 1965 where he talked about the Africans on the continent supporting the Africans in Los Angeles. There was the rebellion taking place in Los Angeles, and Amilcar Cabral, speaking from Tanzania, mentioned the rebellion that was taking place in Los Angeles, California. But we wanted to listen to Mulgrew Miller, who recently passed away, unfortunately. He was a young man out of Greenwood, Mississippi, heavily influenced by Horace Silver and Oscar Peterson from Canada. And Oscar Peterson's came from a Garveyite family. We've talked about that before. But let's listen to Mulgrew Miller speaking about Horace Silver.
Album, that was the first record I heard of Horace's, and when I first heard Woody Shaw and Joe Henderson, I think it, as everyone knows, you know, Horace had that earthy kind of thing that touched you where you live, you know, that kind of bluesy earthiness, funkiness, as the, you know, as it was called, you know, he just reached you at the core, you know. That being said, I personally feel that it's the whole funky bluesy thing has been, well, maybe if not overstated, but certainly stated enough. But what has been understated and underwritten about Horace is what a thinker he is. You know, he wasn't just a bebop piano player that played funky. Horace was a real imaginative and inventive improviser, you know, and still is. And I think that hasn't been noted enough in the reviews and critiques and things that I've read about Horace over the years, you know, a brilliant thinking improviser. And, of course, a huge influence over a whole generation of piano players.
And his compositions, too.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, Horace's compositions have been the vehicles for many great solos, and recorded widespread by all kinds of musicians, jazz and otherwise.
Thank you. yourself, you turn and run. But if you have a change of heart, Ricky, don't lose that number. You don't wanna call nobody else. Send it off in a letter to yourself.
Walking around and acting silly. When dizzy places on, I blow my top. I don't dig no other music, country, rock, or pop. I plant beans and I plant taters. I plant corn and some tomatoes. When Yardbird plays his horn, I just can't stop. I'm in the country, but I dig people. I may be a country stiff. My manner is not too hip, but jazz takes me on a trip. That's the way it is. I love burning this. I am not a city slicker, smoking pot and drinking liquor. And being in the kiss, I'm just a flop. I'm a trip from the country, but I'm big, big bop. We'll be right back. acting silly. When dizzy places on, I blow my top. I don't dig none with the music, country, rock or pop. I plant beans and I plant tears. I plant corn and some tomatoes. When yard bird places on, I just can't stop. I may be from the country, but I dig the bop. I may be a country snip. My manner is not too hip. But just take me on a trip. That's the way it is. Out of burning days, I am not a city slicker. Smoking pot and drinking liquor. And being if I guess I'm just a flop. I may be from the country, but I dig the bop.
Non God Def, testing out my Wolof, and for all you people out there who speak Wolof, all the people in Senegal and elsewhere, and we were listening to the music of Andy Bay, we were listening to the music of Steely Dan, and Steely Dan, I guess they were thieves because they definitely lifted a song for my father from Horace Silver, and we also heard from the late Mulgrew Miller, who was a great pianist born in Greenwood, Mississippi, influenced by Horace Silver, and Andy Bay was born in Newark, New Jersey, and his older sister, Salome Bay, lives here in Toronto, Canada. She married Howard Matthews, who is, they are both very ill at the moment. Howard was born in St. Kitts, and Salome is from Newark, New Jersey. And Andy Bay is a pianist and a vocalist, and he is an openly gay jazz musician. And he is, they came through the Moorish American, they were Moorish Americans. Noble Drew Ali started the Moorish American Science Temple, I think it was in 1917 in Newark, New Jersey. And Salome Bay's father and Andy Bay's father was a member of the Moorish American Science Temple, and then he became a Sunni Muslim. And he made Hajj before Malcolm X. That's what Salome told me. And Malcolm said in his autobiography that he was the first African born in America that made Hajj. And I don't know how true that is, because black people from the United States have been making Hajj for many, many, many years. But if you are a Muslim, you can do that research. And we would check that out because that's something that we study. Our people are Muslim, Christians, Rastas, and we have our own African traditional religions, and we are interested in all of that. And we're getting ready to complete our tribute to the great Horace Silver, and Andy Bay is not on this particular tune, but this is a real famous song by Andy Bay. But no, I'm getting ahead of myself. We're not going to be on next week. We're going to be preempted from 11 to 5. There's going to be a broadcast, Building African Community Empowerment, the African Building African Community Empowerment Project. Dealing with the whole crisis of imperialism, and we hope you listen to this very important broadcast, and we will be black on the 16th of February, but next week between 11 and 5, stay tuned to Uhuru Radio and check out the Building the African Community Development Project, and We will be discussing how we're going to deal with the impending imperialist crisis that's on us right now, and we're going to
end our tribute to Horace Silver with Filthy McNasty.
We're recording up here this evening, live, we hope, from the Village Gate. We'd like for y'all to help us get in the groove. Let your hair down and come on and get in the music with us. We would like to do for you at this time a brand new composition of ours, written about a mythical young man of rather dubious character. We'd like to have you all join in with us on this one and help us find the groove by patting your feet or popping your fingers or clapping your hands or shaking your heads or shaking whatever else you want to shake while we do a little thing we call Filthy McNasty.
Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond. And I would like to thank Sandra Forrest for teching today's show. I would like to thank our regular technical person, Lisa Watson, who's not here today. And we will be back on February the 16th. And we're getting ready to rebroadcast an interview that we did with Alnisa Barbara Banks. And Barbara Banks is the publisher, editor of the Challenger, the Buffalo Black Weekly. And this is Norman Otis Richmond saying that we will see you in the whirlwind, and take care of yourself.
Me and my wife walked all over town. Everywhere we go, folks would turn us down. It's a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. Spread the news all around. Now come along, people. Listen to me. Don't try to find no home in Washington, D.C. It's a bourgeois town. At least a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I'm gonna spread the news all around. Me and my neighbor was standing upstairs. Heard a white man say, don't want no niggas up there. It's a bourgeois town. At least a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town, I'm gonna spread the news all around. Mistreated by no bourgeoisie. It's a bourgeois town. At least a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. No more. Spread the news all around. Politicians in Washington, they know how to throw a colored man a nickel just to see him bow. It's a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I'm gonna spread the news all around. Tell your people and listen to me. Don't try to find no home in Washington, D.C. It's a bourgeois town. At least it's a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I'm gonna spread the news all around. Me and my wife walked all over town. Even some colored folks turned us down. It's a bourgeois town. And it's a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I'm gonna spread the news all around.
Uhuru, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. We just listened to Odetta's Bourgeois Blues, a song that was written by the great Lead Belly, who was born in Louisiana but grew up in Texas. And joining me on the line is Alnisa Barbara Banks, the publisher and editor of the Buffalo Challenger, or the Challenger, a great Black Weekly in Buffalo, New York. And Ms. Banks, if I'm not mistaken, you were born in Texas as well, weren't you?
Yes, that's right, Henderson, Texas. I sure was.
So you got something in common with Lead Belly, huh?
Uh-huh, yes.
So how have you been doing?
I'm sorry, the connection got a little... Norman, can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear. Can you hear me?
Okay, I can hear you now. I'm sorry.
Okay, I was saying,
I was saying that you were born in Texas as well, but we wanted to talk about the Buffalo Challenger. Now, the Buffalo Challenger is a weekly, and I ran across you on the internet, and I wrote for the Buffalo Challenger for many years. So basically, yes, I want you to outline, you know, what is the Buffalo Challenger all about, and how long have you been in existence?
Well, the Challenger is a weekly African newspaper that was founded in 1963, so we're 50 years old. And it was, like, you know, most newspapers, born out of a necessity for Africans to speak for themselves. In 1963, I mean, the backdrop in which the Challenger was born, you had, I think it was the Medgar Evers was murdered in 1963. You had the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham being bombed. You had Dr. Martin Luther King's famous I Have a Dream speech. So it was a historic era. And the Challenger, like a lot of black newspapers born in that era, spoke to the needs of African people. And we still pride ourselves in speaking to the needs, because the more things change, the more they stay the same.
But Elnisa Barbara Banks didn't own the paper 50 years ago, because you're not 50, you're not 50 yet anyway, right?
Yeah, right. You're very cute, Norman. No, I've been there for the last 35.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I just want to get it clear.
I've been there for the last 35. And when interestingly enough, when I came, the Challenger was on the downstroke, so to speak.
Right.
And we had to reinvigorate the legacy, because the fight had not ended, but people had stopped fighting.
Right.
And so I've been there since 1979, almost 34, 35 years.
I cut you off. Go ahead.
As the saying goes, the struggle continues.
But the Challenger, did it start in San Francisco?
No. The San Francisco connection was with Dr. Carlton Goodlett,
right,
who was at one point my partner.
Oh, okay.
Who had the newspapers out on the coast. But the Challenger was founded in Buffalo, New York, by former State Assemblyman Arthur O. Eve, a young man, and two other young men by the names of Calvin Kimbrough and John Moore. Calvin and John both are deceased, but Assemblyman Eve is still alive. And, they were true advocates at that time, because a lot was happening in Buffalo as things were happening around the country. And we had a negative and hostile white press. And
right,
they basically had to speak to those needs.
Now, Buffalo, New York, your paper covers Buffalo, Rochester. Do you cover Syracuse, like the whole that all?
No. We're Buffalo, Rochester, Niagara Falls, and a small area called Lackawanna, which is like a suburb of Buffalo.
Right.
As far as New York State, we are the largest circulated newspaper in upstate New York, or in the state outside of New York City. We're 500, approximately 500 miles from New York City. So outside of New York City, we basically cover that area. Our goal has been for a while, and is to actually reach down as far as Syracuse, but we've not been able to meet that goal as yet. But we're working on it.
Syracuse was quite a way, but I wanted to ask you, could you describe the content of the Buffalo Challenger in 2014? Like, you have news, local, national, international news
right,
columns. Could you talk about what is the content of the Challenger?
Well, the content of the paper, we are a community newspaper, and so our primary responsibility is to the community that we service. So you have a lot. We have the community news, a lot of which, you can't find anywhere else. But we also try very hard to incorporate national and international news as it impacts on Africans, African Americans. And so we do have a small Rochester section. We do not only local briefs, but we do our national and international news. Like, for example, this week we covered the first woman president in Central Africa.
African Republic.
And the new trial for the brother down in South Carolina, the 14-year-old black boy who was executed about 70 years ago, was the youngest in history to ever be executed. So, you know, but these are just things we try to just update our community on, and then we run a health, you know, we run health, and most of our health issues that we run are preventive. We try to run preventive information for people on how to stay healthy so they won't have to go to the doctor. And we have our editorial section, which is, we cover, again, national and international. For example, one of the features we do is called Our Story. And we try to feature, that's our story, our history, little history section every week, so that we don't have to once a year talk about our history. And like this week we featured the Children's Crusade, which a lot of people may not know that 50 years ago last May, that thousands of students marched in Birmingham as part of the Children's Crusade against, you know, oppression.
Right.
And then there's a solitary confinement, a major solitary confinement workshop going on here tomorrow. We run photos, and we run the kid who excelled in school and entertainment. Our entertainment, you know, which speaks for itself again. Local entertainment and national and international entertainment. Our problem is we just don't have enough room for all of the things we'd like to do, but we do have a website, and we're, you know, in the process now of really building that so that we can expand on the news and information that we're putting in the newspaper through by way of our website, which is challengercn.com.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. Now, Buffalo, New York is notorious for creating disc jockeys all around. If we go to look at the whole radio situation, I have made and will continue to make the argument that Buffalo, New York has had the top DJs inside the United States, beginning with Frankie Crocker, Imhotep, Gary Bird, a good friend of mine, Carol Blackman, who was Buffalo and went to Atlanta.
Yes, she's
and
in Atlanta.
And there are people. There's so many people that went from Buffalo, New York, to Texas, to California, and you also the Challenger is one of the few African publications, weekly publications, that really deals with the fight. We have the Buffalo Challenger. We have the, there's a paper called Our Weekly in Los Angeles, California. I've written for them. Then there's the San Francisco Bayview. And then there's the Jackson Advocate, Charles Tisdale. Alice Tisdale, who was, Charles passed away, but Alice Tisdale is still in the land of the living. But as a black weekly, the Challenger is one of the few black papers that are not dealing with the debutante balls and
we do deal with the debutante balls, but in perspective, you know what I'm saying. That's not the news. Like I said, the hat trick, the high wire trick, is to service the community and keep them happy and interested in their local, you know, whatever, social thing, but at the same time provide the reality of what's going on around the world and how it impacts them. And
I don't want to cut you, but that whole, you're servicing that element of the community, because that's part of what's taking place in Buffalo. But go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't want to cut you.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. But right. But you know, if I had my druthers, I would, the whole thing would be dealing with, you know, very, very very tough issues, and we just don't have the space right now. And when you spoke of the Jackson Advocate and Brother Tisdale, who was one of my mentors, you know, I adored Brother Tisdale, and when I came into the Challenger, that was one of my role models, was to try to emulate what he was doing down there. So we had a really good relationship. We used to exchange information, and he used to send us words of encouragement. So, you know, soldiers, many of the soldiers are gone, but the fight rages on. So I'm not sure if the young generation understands how important it is to, as John Russwurm said 186 years ago when they founded the first black newspaper, we wish to plead our own cause. Too long have others spoken for us. That was their mantra. And so we adopted that as our slogan as well when I came in 1979. And I readopted it because the people before me, when they first started out, that was their mantra, and I just carried it through.
Right. Now, the history of the African press in the United States, we have the most successful newspapers we've had have been the Black Panther newspaper, the Muhammad Speak, and the Marcus Garvey's newspaper, and we still haven't been able to surpass Mr. Garvey's paper, because Garvey's paper was printed in French, Spanish, and English, and he had a daily for 3 years. But the Challenger is in the tradition of the Panther, the Muhammad Speaks, and the Negro World.
Right. Well, I think that Brother Garvey had his own presses, didn't he?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, which is critical. And we're in the spirit of those papers. We're not able right now to do as much hard hitting and information as we'd like to. Again, because it is a different time, and it's very, very difficult. Sometimes it's very difficult to even print, because printing is so expensive now. It's
That's
a very
right.
expensive venture. Interestingly enough, my printer is in Canada.
That's interesting, right?
Yeah, I print out of Canada. We find it to be just a lot easier to deal with the Canadian Europeans, and we have a very good working relationship with them. But it's very tough, because money just is all about money right now, and so you don't even find the kind of volunteerism, the spirit of volunteerism that existed when I came in 79 is long removed. You know, everyone who comes in now wants to get paid. You have young people coming in now not wanting to, as I always say, we're an institution that thinks it's a business.
Right.
You know, so they don't come in wanting to help sustain this institution. They come in, they want to get paid, and they want to get paid like I'm Gannett News Corporation or something like that. So it's a different time.
They come to you like you're Bill Gates, right?
Yeah, which is really funny.
let me say that I write for the Burning Spear newspaper, which is the organ of the African People Socialist Party. That's, I guess, the longest-standing revolutionary black newspaper that we have. But I used to write for a publication called the Inner City Voice, which was an organ of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and we couldn't get our paper printed in Detroit. We had to send our paper to Chicago to get it printed by the same people that used to print the Muhammad Speaks. That's a serious issue.
Yeah, it's a very serious issue. It's a very costly. It's a very costly issue right now, which is one of the reasons a lot of, as you know, newspapers are folding. But The interesting thing about the African American newspapers, whether they realize it or not, is that they have a niche. They have a niche, and despite the struggles, we can definitely get through it because there's still a digital divide. And even though everybody's, they say everybody's on the internet, but everybody's not. When we come out, our papers are gone. They're gone. So whether they're on the internet, they still want their challenger. And that, that gives us encouragement to just try to keep it going, that alone.
Is your paper free or do you charge for it now?
The paper's free now.
Right.
We charged for a while, but, the trend is free. In Buffalo, there are numerous weeklies, and they're all free, except, the only papers that are charged for in this area is the Buffalo News, the major newspapers, and, of course, the Times and all of those papers that come in. So we had to, we had to get in step. And it's been helpful to do that in terms of our visibility, and so it's something I probably should have done a long time ago. It makes life a little easier.
Let me say this, that I used to write for a publication called Contrast in Toronto, and they charged 25 cents before, but the competition came out and gave theirs away free and basically said, we have more advertisers than Contrast, so Contrast had to basically give themselves away free because of it was a move by the right-wing advertisers, I shouldn't say right-wing advertisers, but most advertisers, people that corporations are right wing, people that supported the Negro newspapers were, basically ran you had to charge for the paper, and the paper, the Contrast, was basically the more radical paper. And,
And is the Contrast paper, still around? Is the Contrast still printing?
Contrast is no longer in the land of the living. No, ma'am. No.
Okay. Yeah. It's difficult. Like I said, we're an institution that thinks it's a business, and because that's the mold I place myself and the paper in. Because as an institution, you don't just give it up. And as an institution, it's not about the money. It's not about the profit margin. It's not about, me getting a new BMW next year. It's not about that. It's about keeping the line of communication open for people who need it. We have to have our own voice. Well, woe to the community that does not have it. You have to be able to speak to the needs of your people and your community, because the other press, they have a lot of tricks up their sleeves, but they still, if it walk like a duck, if it quack like a duck, that's what it is. And their job is to maintain the status quo. So they're only going to give you so much and so many colored people's pictures every week, and that's about it. And corny columnists that don't even have their finger on the button.
What does the African people look like? When we talk about Buffalo, New York, like TV, radio, and print, how many Africans are reading the news on TV, on commercial radio, and
not very many. We have BLK. We have WUFO Radio, which is a black-owned radio station. And in fact, it just became locally owned. It was owned by Sheridan for many years. And they're over 50 years old. And
they
were just purchased by a young lady named Sheila and Reverend Pridgen, who's a very popular minister here and who's also a council person. He's the president of the Common Council. So they just together purchased WUFO from Sheridan Broadcasting. So we're looking for good things to come out of that. And then, of course, we have WBLK, which WUFO is the AM station. We have WUFO, the BLK, which is the FM station, which was founded by the Hound Dog, legendary George. I can't think of his last name now. I think
but he was like a white guy who loved black music, right?
And so
George Lorenz.
They don't. His son took over for many years, and they don't own it anymore. But it's I forgot the conglomerate that owns them. But they're still, you know, black oriented, and all of their DJs, of course, are African. But as far as TV, the news, the major weekly, they have one regular columnist. They have a couple people on the editor, one on the editorial board, I think, and they have a couple of reporters. Maybe all total five. Maybe I'm not sure. On television, you know, it's a snowstorm almost every night. You know, you don't see us. You know, you know, it's a snowstorm. Okay, in the middle of summer, it's snow. You don't see us on TV as much. We don't have any major anchors. There's no major anchors, and there's, you know, and people will come and then they'll go because Buffalo is a tough town. It's rough, right. Though. It's a tough town, yeah.
Right.
Buffalo actually has the third highest poverty rate of any large city, with 30% of the families living in poverty, according to the statistics.
Buffalo is a town. I cut you off. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. No, that's okay. Go ahead.
I said Buffalo is a town that is one of the towns that people are leaving, like that whole Buffalo, Cleveland. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. People are leaving there. Not necessarily because of the weather, but because the industrial base has been rocked in terms of you can't get work in Buffalo anymore, right?
No, at one time Buffalo was a boom town. They called it, actually the nickname for Buffalo was the Queen City on the Great Lakes.
Right.
And that is because of the industry. You had Bethlehem Steel. You had all these steel mills. You had automobile plants. I mean, it was a boom town, and a lot of African people came from down south to Buffalo for jobs. That's how we migrated. That's why we came here. We came here for the jobs. The jobs were in Buffalo. On Friday, as the old saying goes, the eagle would fly every Friday. And
right.
So, interestingly enough, the murder rate, the whole atmosphere of the African community was different. I mean, people had jobs, and so they had money, and so they didn't have to do any that much. I mean, you're always going to have your illegal activity, but it wasn't a major necessity. Everything now, unfortunately, is a hustle because Buffalo went from, you know, that steel mill working class town, you know, put the food on the table, the father could get a job and bring home the bacon, to white collar, and the Bethlehem closed, all those mills closed, everything shut down, where the average person that didn't have a PhD or whatever, get a job, and it's just now coming, you know, balancing itself out. It was really rough, but it's slowly coming back because now everything's being pushed towards the medical. You know, the medical movement, they have this thing called the medical corridor here, which is just, you know, blowing up. So a lot of the training now is in the medical field, where people can get jobs in the medical field. But
right.
it's blowing up. But unemployment is a problem in Buffalo. 40, I think it's something like 45%. There's 33%. Black men in Buffalo make up about 32%.
Right.
Or 32 or 30% of all the black men in Buffalo, over the age of 16, don't have jobs. 45% of them don't have jobs. That's documented.
Right.
They had a march on jobs here back in October, but I don't think much came of it except the march. And I haven't heard any more about, you know, the march. So Things are moving, but not necessarily in our community. And we have a black mayor.
Is it, I don't want to cut you, but is it possible for you to come back next week at the same time? Because I really wanted to explore the history of that industrial thing, but we only have 3 minutes. We have to get off this phone.
Oh, okay.
Is that possible next week, or you want to do the week after next?
Well, we could try for next week, Norman. I think I can do next week.
Okay, because I really want to continue this conversation, but I really appreciate it. And just give the website out for the Buffalo Challenger and how people can get a hold of the paper.
Okay, it's ChallengerCN.com.
ChallengerCN.com, okay.
Yeah, and again, it's, you know, we're not the Panther paper, but the spirit, we're in the spirit of advocacy. Our spirit is there.
All right.
Okay, thank you so much, Norman.
All right, we will definitely get a hold of you next week then. All right.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And okay, we have been speaking with Alnisa Barbara Banks, the challenger of the publisher and the editor of the Challenger, or sometimes called the Buffalo Challenger.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.